With Thanksgiving leftovers nearly gone, now would be a good time to try out some new recipes for this holiday season. So get out your strainers, spoons, and saucepans. Food writer Susan Chang is back with her list of the best cookbooks of 2009. Susan Chang reviews cookbooks for the Boston Globe and NPR's Kitchen Window, and she joins us from NPR member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome back, Susan.
Good to be back, Leanne.
A lot of cookbooks this year, and a lot of them from the front covers at least, look fabulous. Let's talk about Gourmet Today. It's edited by Ruth Reichel, the editor of Gourmet Magazine, which published its last issue in November. But this book has 1,000 recipes. Which ones did you try?
So what I tried was the Japanese sesame spinach, which was fantastic, just wonderful, with, you know, just a little bit of sweetness and mirin and soy. And I tried the lemon rice with peanuts. My husband tried the chicken with shallots, garlic, and vinegar.
Mm. And the fact that each recipe is actually edited and selected by the editor-in-chief, Ruth Reichel, and she wrote introductions to each chapter. I mean, you feel like someone you know has come into your kitchen.
That's right. With the gourmet books, you can feel very confident that everything's going to work.
I actually love Pleasures of Cooking for One by Judith Jones. I like it for the name.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is fantastic. I mean, you know, it's really hard to break down recipes that serve six people into one that might, you know, I can eat tonight and then maybe save it for a day or two over. Mm-hmm. People probably saying, freeze the leftovers. Yeah. But still, she's an interesting woman, and what she has to say and write and eat in this book is great.
I think that it's a particularly appealing book because we tend to think of cooking as not really being worth it if it's just for yourself. And this completely turns that notion on its head, because I think what Judith Jones really manages to get across is that cooking for yourself isn't something you do despite working so hard all day, but because you work so hard. You deserve something wonderful to eat at the end of your day. You deserve not to have to eat out of a takeout container.
And we have to mention her connection with Julia Child. They work together.
That's right.
On the art of Mastering the Art of French Cooking, if I'm not mistaken.
The very one.
Staff of Life. Bread.
Mm-hmm.
I love reading bread books, and I'm starting to, you know, master my yeast. but this one is by Peter Reinhardt, and it's called Artisan Breads Every Day. What does this book tell me about dough that I don't already know?
What Peter Reinhardt does better than anybody else is he goes into this headspace where he works and works and works on bread. He works day and night. He lives and breathes bread. And then he comes out with something that you and I can understand. We can take it into our home kitchen. We can, you know, make a quick dough. We can throw it in the fridge from anywhere 4 hours to 4 days and, you know, and still come out with something that tastes fantastic.
Well, from artisan bread to mastering the art of Chinese cooking. And this is by a woman, Eileen Yin-Fei Lo.
Yeah, I think that what's happened with Chinese cookbooks in recent years is really wonderful. It used to be that we would get cookbooks that essentially would give you the ingredients, but they would be a little bit laconic about the techniques. So, but nowadays, I've seen some really wonderful cookbooks that spell it all out. They've got pictures. They've got, you know, what to watch for. And I have to tell you, I made the baked pork buns with the barbecued pork. Oh, my God. I actually had to hide them in my fridge so no one else would find them first. And I sent one to school with my son, and it practically caused a riot.
I'm not surprised. there are several Chinese restaurants around NPR headquarters in Washington. And, you know, I go searching out the pork buns, but the prospect of being able to actually make them is making my mouth water.
Yeah, you can actually do it. Not that hard.
So you had to pick 10 cookbooks for 2009. Which one would you give as a gift for the aspiring chef in your life?
You know, one of the 10 that I chose that I haven't talked about is the Asian Dumplings book. And I think I might give that to people just so that I don't have to be the person who makes the dumplings all the time.
Susan Chang reviews cookbooks for the Boston Globe and NPR's Kitchen Window. She joined us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. And for Susan's picks of the top 10 cookbooks of 2009, visit our website, npr.org. Susan, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. How safe is your chicken dinner? Apparently not very. A recent Consumer Reports investigation put the birds to the test. They bought 382 uncooked whole chickens from over 100 different stores in 22 states and hired an outside lab to test for disease-causing bacteria. The results: 2/3 of the whole broiler chickens they tested harbored salmonella and another pathogen called Campylobacter, both other leading bacterial causes of foodborne illness. Urvashi Rangan is the author of the Consumer Reports study. She says the results are troubling.
This industry to us remains as a dirty industry.
Consumer Reports says organic chickens fared the best in their testing.
Almost 60% of air-chilled organic were found to be clean of any pathogens. Purdue came in next at about 56% clean. And the worst players in our deck were Tyson and Foster Farms, coming in at less than 20% clean.
The National Chicken Council has responded to the study. In a written statement, the group said, quote, "Like all fresh foods, raw chicken may have some microorganisms present, but these are destroyed by the heat of normal cooking," end quote. So, if you're wary about serving up another whole chicken, experts say there are ways to keep yourself and your family safe. When purchasing raw chicken at the supermarket, make sure it's well wrapped and kept in a plastic bag. This will help protect your hands and other groceries. When cooking the chicken, use a meat thermometer to make sure it reaches an internal temperature of 165 degrees, which is necessary to kill bacteria. Finally, splurging on a cutting board designated just for raw meat is a very good idea. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Marmite is one of the most divisive foods in Britain. You either love it or hate it. It's an edible yeast extract made from the sludge left behind after beer is brewed. It was introduced in Britain under the name Marmite in 1902, and ever since, for many millions living on the British Isles, a breakfast without a thin layer of dark, sticky, tar-like Marmite on toast is an incomplete one. Now, a British expat, Maggie Hall, who lives here in Washington, D.C., has just written a new book about Marmite. And so a few days ago, I went over to her house with one of our producers, Travis Larchuk.
Hi, Guy.
And Travis, you came along because at that point you had never tried it.
Right, and because you told me I didn't have a choice.
Okay. So Travis and I headed to Maggie's house on Capitol Hill.
Come in, it's a shop.
Hello.
Come on, it's a shop.
Ms. Hall?
Yes.
Hi, I'm Guy.
Yeah, Guy. Come on in. Welcome.
Thanks.
Faichue and Travis, good
Hi.
To meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, hello.
So Maggie used to cover America for the British tabloid The Daily Mirror. But for a long time, her secret passion has been Marmite. And we came to talk to her about her new book, which is called The Mishmash Dictionary of Marmite.
And when we walked into her house, there was this spread of Marmite-infused dishes all on the dining room table.
Look at all that Marmite on the table.
Well, I opened my big jar for you guys.
And she even made a Marmite cake for us, an unpleasant combination of Marmite, orange marmalade, and shredded cheddar cheese.
We have sausages cooked in Marmite, Marmite water marinade in the oven. We have, of course, the biggest jar of Marmite you can buy, which I just brought back from England.
And then there is this sort of crumbly egg.
That is an egg salad with Marmite.
Okay. So now, all right, so we've set the scene here. Now the big question. How did somebody figure out that you could take the sludge from a brewery and turn it into something you eat?
It was Louis Pasteur, who abandoned for a while his making milk safe for us. And he teamed up with the brilliant German chemist, Baron Justus von Liebig. And between them, they came up with this formula that turned this horrible, horrible, gross-looking stuff into a vaguely edible mess.
And a few years later, a group of British investors actually bought the recipe and started marketing this sludge as Marmite. And ever since, it's been hawked as a kind of a cure-all for everything from baldness to anemia to malaria. And even for a time, doctors in Britain would recommend that nursing mothers use it to help wean their babies off the breast.
And it's rich in vitamin B and folic acid.
Right. Anyway, about 10 years ago, Maggie Hall was finally inspired to write this book about Marmite. So she wrote a manuscript and she took it to one publisher who rejected it flat out.
Another publisher said, "Is there any sex in it?" I said, "No." He said, "No, no, won't work."
Eventually, she did get a deal, which is how we ended up hearing about this book.
So there we were.
At her house with all this Marmite on the table. And Travis, it would have been impolite not to try some of the Marmite cake or the Marmite egg salad or the Marmite sausages.
Maggie, there is a strong smell of Marmite in this room that we're sitting in. And I guess I could describe it as kind of a sweet, salty, but overpowering smell. Mm. How would you describe the taste of Marmite?
You see, I have an asbestos mouth. My mother always used to say, "Oh, no wonder you like Marmite, because you used to eat anchovies whole from 18 months of age."
I have eaten Marmite. I do eat Marmite.
I think you're an aficionado guy.
A little bit of aficionado. But our producer, Travis Larchuk, with us, has not tried it before. So I'm going to eat it because it looks and smells delicious. We'll see what Travis thinks.
Get this spittoon ready.
Maggie says for beginners like me, the best way to try Marmite is on a piece of hot buttered toast, which is the traditional way to eat Marmite.
Travis, go for it.
Yes.
Oh, God, his eyes.
You know what? I need to take a bite because I've been waiting.
Oh, that is beautiful.
Delicious.
It's just thoroughly unpleasant from start to finish. I can feel it going down my throat.
Okay, Travis, you've now had 24 hours to mull this over. Was it really all that bad?
Well, Guy, one time I tried one of those pellets from one of those vending machines at a duck pond that you use to feed the ducks.
Oh, yeah.
And that was better than Marmite.
That's our producer, Travis Larchuk, who courageously agreed to try Marmite, Britain's favorite edible yeast spread. Travis, thanks.
No problem, Guy.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. There's sharp cheddar, and then there's really sharp cheddar. In Wisconsin, a 15-year-old cheddar is now on sale for $50 a pound, and it comes from a pretty sharp cheesemaker, the Hook's Cheese Company in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. The company says it's one of the oldest cheeses you can buy in the country. Tony Hook from Hook's Cheese is with me now, and Mr. Hook, how does this cheese taste?
It's fantastic.
I figured you would say that. Could you describe it for us? I imagine it's not the taste of the cheddar that you might find in the refrigerator aisle in the average grocery store.
Probably not. It's got quite a bit of flavor. It hasn't got any sort of bitterness to it as to what some people would expect for a real old cheddar. And once a cheddar cheese gets past 3 to 5 years, it kind of starts losing that acidic cheddar flavor also. So it just kind of tends to smooth out.
Now, how would one enjoy this?
You'd probably want to just eat it by itself or with a fine wine or a good hearty stout beer.
You wouldn't put it on a cheeseburger?
On a cheese what? Excuse me.
You wouldn't want to put this on a cheeseburger?
No, I don't think so. I don't think you'd want to put it in your mac and cheese. Cook it too long and lose some of your flavors.
Now, this has been described as the single malt scotch of cheddar, quite an accomplishment to produce a 15-year-old cheddar. How did you do this?
We have been aging cheddars for over 20 years, and at the time we started, we weren't actually setting out to age anything for 15 years, I guess. But as we aged some of it out and it was developing such good flavor, we decided we'd set some of it aside to age for 12 years and then for 15 years.
People listening to this may wonder, okay, if he's selling 15-year-old cheese, just how old is that cheese that you see at the supermarket that's shredded or in regular packaging?
The stuff you typically see in the shredded packages are maybe 1 to 3 months old. If it does say sharp cheddar on it but doesn't give a year, it's probably less than a year.
Is this your oldest cheese?
This is my oldest cheese I have for sale.
So what does that mean?
I still have a few pounds left of what it was 15, 2 years ago, so I still have a few pounds left of the 17-year-old, but that's for personal consumption for the family.
Oh, private reserve.
Yeah, not for sale.
Under no circumstances.
I don't even have a label for it.
Oh, don't even ask. Well, all the best to you, sir. Happy holidays.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
That was Tony Hook of Hook's Cheese Company in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. He was talking to us about his 15-year-old cheddar cheese, now for sale at $50 a pound.